you know, not to become personal in this, but I was always surprised that when I came home in March, I had a meeting with Walter, with Warren Christopher. That meeting did not go particularly well. And with Newsom and with Saunders. At my own initiative, I had lunch with Gary Sick, who was on the NSC staff, as you know, at the time. But no effort was made by Brzezinski or anybody else at a policy level, outside the state where I went in that NSC structure, to sit down and talk with me of what my views were, to get sort of a first-hand thoughts from the guy who was going to go back, reluctantly, I would say, the déchargé corps. But there was sort of a strange move among many people in town. There was once a big shock and distress. And then people are always swayed more by hope than analysis. Something I point out in the lecture at the Foreign Service Institute. And there's great hope that somehow we have lost a lot, but we can do business with the government. And some people sort of blithely tended, and I found this very difficult the next few months, tended to ignore the fact that our hopes were built on or resting on very thin ice.
You said that the meeting with Christopher didn't go too well. Was he less interested in accommodation or
no, well, he didn't go particularly well on personnel.
Oh, personnel, okay.
I also felt that he was very... I told him some things I'm sure he did not want to hear. I was not physically in the best shape at the time. I hadn't slept pretty much for weeks and weeks. And was flown directly in from Tehran, had one night's sleep, and saw him the next day. So I was pretty weary. The bags were down to my jaw. Bags of my eyes were down to my jaws. I was very somber and very gloomy about the future. And it felt that people didn't quite understand what a major blow U.S. interest had suffered in the air. It's the kind of talk that people at a political level very rarely got to hear. And he showed no more reception to my views than that, really. Again, I'm sure part of it was my own appearance probably put him off. In fact, he did use a phrase later on that I was a burnt out case. I will never forgive Mr. Christopher for his behavior.
Were there any groups in the State Department or elsewhere that were less inclined towards work animals, less inclined towards work animals than any but wanted, that they were a more hostile approach?
I never had anything come to my attention whatsoever on this. I think there was at least a realization on the part of most people that, of all people, is that the worst had happened. The optimists hoped that somehow the new government could be dealt with. And everybody else felt the situation was basically hopeless in terms of U.S. initiative, a strong U.S. initiative. There's no opportunity, no room for it, no inclination whatsoever.
How much of a grasp did you and the embassy political officers have of the workings of the political system that was emerging for the first months of the revolution?
I think we had a very good understanding of it, in the sense that there was no system. I mean, in the way we would like to look at a hierarchical system, but that power was regional and, if you want to call it, ward. Each town was probably broken up into different sections where the committees, the comités, based around the mosque, the local mosque usually, they ran government in that area. And we reported very, very extensively on this kind of thing. we, you know, we're aware of this every single day. In fact, we were trying to recover household effects, for example, of people who had been evacuated, and a small band of our military people would go into these areas, incinerated clothes, of course, and we're always, in each different area, had to work out a separate modus vivendi with the comité. Some of the comité leaders were rabidly anti-American, and we could not get into their area at all. Others were quite accommodating and helpful. Others were venal. We'd get into a house if we gave up the fridge and the adding machine and the TV. I mean, you found all levels. But day by day, we were terribly aware of the fact that power was very, very in small units throughout, and that the central government itself had practically no power whatsoever.
Remember, there was a revolutionary council to try to sort of coordinate everything. How much was known about it and its membership?
About the membership, practically nothing. This was one of our key objectives, of to try to find out who they were, simply because if one knows who they are, and if you know them or know a way to them, then you can talk about your problems. You can talk about the larger policy issues, and which I really didn't have an awful lot to say, except what I mentioned to you, and our willingness to cooperate with them on military supply of the future, etc. But that I wanted to try. I know I talked to people who I later found out were in, whom I suspected at the time were in the part of the Revolutionary Council. And I would very casually say, oh, by the way, who are the members? And I'd always get sort of a sly grin and say, well, that's secret. So we had very little hard knowledge of who was in the council. And to this day, I'm still not sure who all the members were. I mean, time had gone by on that. So I spent a lot of time researching. But it was one of those things, I said, we were, by diplomatic necessity, dealing with the government. And as I said, we were a very decent group of people, by and large. But we knew that actual day-to-day power was in the comités, and that real power, to the extent that anybody had real power at the center, was in the hands of the Revolutionary Council, in a sense, but most prominently Khomeini himself.
To what extent, you sort of alluded to this earlier, I think, but to what extent did you see factional divisions among revolutionary leadership?
Within the people who took over the government, held the cabinet posts, I didn't see any incident. There wasn't time, no issue in fundamentally. They were trying to survive. So you had that group of people who were essentially the national, the old National Front leadership. Well, in fact, I guess all of them, except Yazdi and Entezan, were probably a little too young to be terribly active, except the students in the National Front days. But all the rest of the people came out of the old National Front. One was perfectly aware, of course, that you had a whole host of people around the revolution, around the religious leaders, who had absolutely no faith or desire that the faith that Bazargan could survive, nor did they want him to survive. In terms of divisions within the religious element, it was very hard for us to get a handle on that. We had come to know slightly the Heshdi and knew of his importance. And shortly after the revolution was successful, we made some contact with Ayatollah Khamenei and his people, more in a humanitarian sense than a political sense. But we did not have that deep, detailed knowledge of the divisions and who went to whom, who had the real strength in Tehran, certainly, in terms of the big figures. And don't forget, we had evacuated our entire agency staff and we were down to just a couple of political losses. We brought Victor Thompson, came up from Isfahan after he closed the post. Mike Matrenko came down from Tabriz after he closed his post. So we had two first-rate linguists and people who knew Iran, and they were walking into a Tehran scene in which they had to learn a little bit about that, too.
Now, James Bill and others have discussed the extent to which a few CIA people, Vernon Kasson, were in contact with Fadi Sajjar and Entezam, among others, during early 79 and later 79 as part of an effort to build a close political contacts with the moderates among revolutionaries. How much did you know about those efforts? Was that something that...
I think the Kasson thing occurred after I left the country.
Okay, I think I think, according to Bill, there were some contacts early in the early 79 that were reestablished later in the year.
As I recall, Bill's writing, Kasson had met Monty Sutter in France.
That's right.
And then reestablished the, according to what Bill writes, and what he writes is based entirely upon documents, alleged documents that were seized at the embassy, and interviews, so that I'm not aware of that. And I personally felt at the time, this is before, because I think Bonnie Sutter had become president, or was going to be a, it was clear it was one of the candidates. I could be wrong in that. One of the things I strongly recommend to Washington is that we withstand any pleas for sort of special covert actions. This is different than covert acquisition of information. Like, the time was not right, we didn't simply didn't know enough of what was going on, and then people started to come up with wild ideas that we resist them as strongly as we could.
You mentioned a few minutes ago some of the, there were some contacts with Ayatollah Khamenei and Beheshti among others, of having a meeting or making an approach towards Khamenei.
Not much at that time. It was in that period, I'm not quite sure of the date, when Ambassador Sullivan sent that famous telegram that you can see the need of it, because he'd gone back and would be sort of like a Gandhi. There was more to the telegram than that. I forget what it was, but that's a more famous phrase of his last. So no, we did, to the best of my memory, we did not propose, nor did the department, except that one time that contact be made at that particular time. I've already gone through, I believe, on the tape of my own efforts in May.
That's right. Now you mentioned earlier your meetings with Bossergon and your impressions of Bossergon. Did you have, I guess you met with Yazdi also?
I met very, very frequently with Yazdi, yes, as deputy prime minister and then as foreign minister.
What were your impressions of him?
Favorable in a couple of respects. He clearly was an intelligent man, and I felt I might have been naive, but I felt that when he and I talked, and he agreed that something could be done, that he would in fact extend his best efforts to do so. So I felt quite comfortable with him in sort of day-to-day dealings. He clearly, of course, is of a totally different background and stripe than Bossergon of the National Front is. I mean, a very religious man, a man who, over the years, I'm not sure I knew this in February when he came back, but by the time our chargé was aware of it, he had been close to Khomeini for a long, long time. We've had contact, as you know, through our embassy in Paris with Yazdi when they were in Paris. And again, he was a reasonable negotiator. So I thought he was a man that one could negotiate with, one could deal with. But he was deeply committed to the revolution, deeply committed to Khomeini. The hatred that he had from the previous regime was made clear to one at all times. I remember at one point pleading with him, if you will, for the lives of Kalafari and Hovea. And I think he may have been somewhat sympathetic to these specifics, but he made very clear to me that the revolutionaries were going to take their share of blood, that the people had been pent up so long, had been so badly treated over the years, that it was politically impossible for the regime to curb at that time the excesses that were going on. In fact, I think as I was talking to him, Kalafari was shot. I know with great emotion when I was thinking, he went over to his desk and he pulled out a file, a fairly thick file, which he claimed had been seized in Southern headquarters, and I have no reason to disbelieve him. It showed a sort of one sheet affairs in Farsi, so I couldn't read it that well. In fact, it was the specifics of the charges and et cetera, what happened to the particular prisoner. And it was sort of the before picture and the after picture. And the after picture always showed the person dead. And it showed some of them clearly, a terrible picture of a young lady naked from the waist. There was a picture of her first, sort of bright, attractive. I say bright, she looked bright. Young lady, and the next picture of her was sort of on a slab from the waist up with burn marks or other marks all over her body. And so Yazoo with a considerable amount of passion in his voice asked how I could expect sort of mercy for the people who had committed such atrocities. I think it's the only time that I saw him really quite upset that I had walked in under instructions to please for the life of a couple of individuals that he felt since had no merit. Yazzie was a clever person, and he, as fates prove, he was unable to make that bridge himself between sort of the Democrats, if you will, and the religious. And as you know, he lost out on November 5th. But to the best of my knowledge, has played very little role since then.
What about Sadek
Gotzadeh? I never met Gotzadeh. I had my public affairs officer put in a request for a meeting with him, but he never would meet with any American to the best of my knowledge. And I think that I was perfectly understanding of that. I mean, association with Americans was hardly the most healthy thing a revolutionary could do. And in many ways, he was that interesting combination of Iranians was in the United States, because you know he had a great deal of trouble in the United States, and eventually I guess we kicked them out. So you know, it was sort of a long-term unhappiness, perhaps even hatred at times for us, but at the same time, certain admiration. He got along easily in American society, but he was very smart. I mean, he did not wish to see him. And I must say, very, very few of my Iranian friends that I had known before the revolution wanted to see me. Again, I did not take that personally. and but they were just simply being smart. They were trying to survive. There was one very nice elderly man that I liked very much. He used to call me up all about every week. He'd just give me his first name. He'd say, "How are you?" I said, "I'm getting along fine, thank you. I just wanted you to know, make sure you're still okay. Hang on." He was the only one that did.
What about Bonnie Sutter? Were there any contacts with him after March? After you returned from...
I had none.
Yeah.
And to the best of my memory, nobody from the embassy. Yeah. Don't forget, Bonnie Sutter, in those early days, was primarily looked upon as one of those academics who was somehow trying to come up with the postulation of an Islamic economic system. I had read in the newspapers and some of the stuff he wrote, and frankly, and this perhaps was error, none of us took him terribly seriously. He did not appear to be a serious figure in the revolution.
Now, you mentioned a while ago your trip back to Washington in March, where you were, you returned with the purpose of trying to develop some permanent arrangement with the new regime. Now, what kind of effort did you make after March to further a modus vivendi or an arrangement with the government?
Just basically going out to meet all the people, all the new ministers. I purposely did not ask the Prime Minister right away for a meeting. I called on a number of ministers, some of whose names I've forgotten, frankly, at this point, and gave them my litany of our desire for a normal relationship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, common interests, et cetera. And with one or two ministers where we'd had previous programs, the education minister, and talking about the possibility of future educational problems with in the past, and what could we do to prevent some of these kind of problems in the future in terms of Iraq's coming to the United States. That we call the minister's name is Shariat Madri, with no relationship directly to the Ayatollah Shariat Madri. So that kind of slow process. I met with the Minister of Economic Affairs and discussed with him a few issues that we had. Once I felt I had laid sufficient groundwork so that the word would trickle up, I called the Prime Minister and I explained that I had not called on him first because I knew, one, he was extraordinarily busy, and that it would be presumptuous of me in my early days as Chargé to call on him, and I called on his ministers and I hoped that he would receive my message. And he said, yes, they had briefed him thoroughly on my talks, and so I repeated the same conversation to him. And we talked about other matters. I remember one time I was asked to see him to get his reaction to the Shah and coming to the United States. And he was quite emotional about this because I think he saw the fact that it caused just a tremendous hue and cry within the country. And he said this in a very moderate terms, though. He just felt that that would be very difficult to have a relationship with us if we did.
Were you under instructions to bring this up?
Yeah. And I asked whether the children, it was the same feeling, did he hold the same feelings, the same concerns as the children can? And they're very human. He expressed concern about their security. That's the first thing he said. Will they be safe? And he made it clear that, no, the same weight would not be held. Everybody's going to specifically ask about the Shah Banu. If she came to the United States, would the reaction be? You know, it would be an equally strong reaction, unless she had came for one of her periodic medical visits and left. He had the same kinds of concerns, of course, that I did. We have, to a degree, I mean, from the United States, a certain obligation to the Shah. It's a question of when we carry out that obligation. I know when I came home in March, I felt very strongly that the Shah should not be permitted. In fact, I was instructed from Ambassador Sullivan to make that point very strongly. We felt we were hanging by our fingernails. Well, the government was also hanging by its fingernails. And it did not feel that it could handle the internal reaction of the Shah and Shabu coming to the United States. And so therefore, if he didn't think his government, which was in a sense like the last hope for a relationship with us, that he couldn't handle that, it was very much in our interest, our national interest, that the Shah not come until a later point. There's nothing personal in this, because I personally, as I mentioned before, I have quite a high regard for the Shah, and certainly a very high regard for the Shah of the Middle. But it was a question of state policy and state interests calling for delay in his arrival.
Was there... How strongly was the State Department interested in facilitating the return of the Shah, or facilitating the entrance of the Shah in the United States? Were they just curious to know what the reaction would be from the Iranian government? Were they interested in actually...
Well, as you know, from throughout the summer, perhaps even starting in the spring, at the political level, there was considerable pressure from Kissinger et al. To, you know, a famous... well, his famous phrase, I forget right now, a man without a country, and sort of thing. So there's a lot of pressure. The professionals at the department felt exactly the way I did, that it would be calamitous for our interests. And therefore, I did not have to persuade them. But if you probably have seen some of these captured documents, Bruce Lang was asked twice. Well, I was only asked once, that I recall, and but I was asked to raise it with the government. It was the State Department. It was simply looking for ammunition. In response to these pressures.
When you carry on these discussions with various ministry officials in spring 79, were there any efforts made to try to restore ordinary commercial relations? Lay the way to return of U.S. firms in terms of trading and investing and so forth?
Not too much. I strongly was against the return of too many business people. I felt the situation was very unstable and that their lives could be in danger. In fact, very few came back. The remnants of some of the major firms stayed on through the revolution, and then, like we did, the same, cleaned up. And very few people came back. I remember one period, former general from Bell Helicopter, came back with a very sensible proposal of how the firm could assist the government, in a sense, in mothballing effectively a large number of helicopters, and, you know, in that climate they need some special treatment. And there was some interest in it, but we were appalled. We had recommended he not come in the first place, and he came to his own company. I saw him with old friend, and he got out of town. We recommended him not hang around very long, make his proposal, and leave a foreign address, if you will, and then get in touch with him.
I've heard that some of the ministry officials complain that the U.S. Government was undermining their position in some ways by refusing to repatriate government funds or not supplying parts were already paid for. Did you get those kinds of complaints when you're dealing with?
Well, sure did. Yeah. I had many complaints that we were holding up. In fact, I guess we were. When people were terribly uncertain of what was going on. But the major problem, in effect, had nothing to do with policy. I mean, the Pentagon and the State Department, within reason, would have been willing to send various spare parts and equipment. But the American legal system, such as it is that American companies all over the United States, but particularly, went to court to prevent the export of this equipment in order to, part of it was pressure, but mainly they hope to be able to sell some of this stuff. I forget what it's called in law, and get back some of the losses. Some companies lost rather heavily through the revolution. So as much of our inability to be forthcoming as Iranians on arms and spare parts by the American court system, but not policy. I remember when Yazdi complained bitterly to me one time, and I explained as best I could my understanding of what was going on legally, and said I would get a more formal statement from our legal division. But I pointed out to him that he had been in the United States for a good part of his life. Surely he understood somewhat our political and legal system. Is that one can go to a federal court or a local judge in each state, and there's not a damn thing in the world the State Department or the U.S. government could do about it except file sort of an appeal on behalf of the Iranian government. And so I suggested to him, I said, not in jest, that they hire a couple of the best law firms they could find to get into the legal, into these legal actions and to defend their position. And I was assured that in some instances, the State Department would have been helpful in sort of amicus curiae, that's all we could have done in these cases. So, while some people might have wanted to drag, and the Pentagon might have wanted to drag the feet, there was no real high policy of not shipping this stuff. And part of it was just people were terribly busy trying to clean up the Iranian aid program coming from the agreement between General Tufani and Eric Von Marbach. That was a tremendous task, and in all the court cases, it was a mess.
This period after you got back from Washington, this period of the spring of 79, when you returned from Washington, did you make any efforts to approach Khomeini at that stage?
I personally didn't. I think I covered it on tape earlier that I was asked what I thought the time was right to see Khomeini.
This at that stage?
It was in May.
Oh, I see.
It was early May. And as I told you before, Barzagan was enthusiastic, he'd make the arrangements, etc. And then the Javits resolution was passed in the Senate. It's one of those sort of, it was a freebie to Senator Javits. It was hell for me. The day after the Javits resolution, 2 or 3 days after it went through, we had tens, hundreds of thousands of people screaming outside our embassy. We're under real threat of being attacked again. The thing it did do was what basically was the excuse that the government used for me not to see Khomeini, and that but he just simply under those circumstances after this expression, this criticism, this of Iran, this intervention into their internal affairs, that he did not wish to see me. And of course, as we know, Walter Cutler was also denied entry.
Was there any effort made by the State Department to convince Javits not to withdraw the resolution or not to trade any further?
Any
effort made to convince Javits to draft the resolution?
The State Department, to the best of my knowledge, because I raised absolute hell about this, and not being forewarned at least, I knew nothing about it until it was just about, like, I'm not even sure they had more than an hour to notice of it. you know, these resolutions go through by voice vote. It's very, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It didn't seem, I'm sure, to Javits himself to be harmful. In fact, it was extraordinarily harmful.
You mentioned that in the meditation, Walter Cutler was withdrawn as ambassador designate. Did you have any role in the appointment? Were you consulted when they were selecting a possible ambassador to Iran? Did they ask for your opinion on that?
No. Not the sort of thing they would.
Yeah.
Walt was an old friend. He and I went to the senior seminar together. I knew him very well. I thought he was an excellent choice. But again, I was looking at it from an American point of view.
Now, towards the end of the embassy provide assistance to Pahlavi regime supporters who were trying to leave the country, escape to the United States, with a bunch of Jackson had to help for these people who were...
We're not in a position really to help anybody. We gave visas to people, and we only had one man in the consul section by this time, so I must admit there probably was a certain amount of political favoritism, but we were giving out so many visas per day that the local employees, the Iranian employees, and this one American also could handle. But we were not having consul lines open and access to the consul section, as long as I was there.
Now, James Bill talks about the granting of visas was used as a means to gather political intelligence for people taking visas. How common was that practice?
These are awfully childish and misguided efforts by one or two people. It was certainly not embassy policy to do so. But, there was some of the people there who were looking, in a sense, for work and looking to try to get more information, thought that this was one way to obtain it. I can't recall ever receiving useful information on that basis. I wasn't aware of how widespread, not widespread, but how widespread was the effort of a couple of people. I later became aware of some of the problem. I will not go into some detail of visas and laid the law down of what would happen, etc., etc., tried to get some regulation into the process.
How did you leave the country?
I should remember the date with great joy, but I remember. I think it was the 20th, 21st, I set for 23rd of June, I don't really remember. It was within those 4 days. Certainly the day I left was one of the happiest in my life, so I should have it with a big red circle on it.
What was your assessment of internal conditions in Iran around the time of your departure?
I felt that the revolution had a number of stages undefined in my mind to go through, and I still wrote, without being very specific. I felt that the government had the most tenuous hold on the situation, that Khomeini would call the shots, and that Americans are likely to be in considerable peril for many, many months to come. If you look up in those books, I think the telegram I sent, a couple of telegrams I sent to Vance prior to my departure, just very, in almost summary form, bringing my thoughts together, I think somewhere in those volumes. I was shocked to find it, because I didn't know any of those copies existed. But as I recall, I think I started off, I said I wanted to give him my thoughts on departure. And they said I must warn him in advance that they are terribly gloomy, and that this might be a result of my experience. So I'm trying to be fair to the secretaries and take into account that I was in a somewhat depressed mood and have been for a long time. I said I thought that the views that I wish to share with him would be largely concurred in by my colleagues and by other Western diplomats. And I think the first phrase of the Clinton is the Iranian revolution is not over. So I felt, I don't mean to say this that I was prescient, but I fully expected another attack on the embassy. I didn't know what it was going to be. My mind had not gone through all the scenarios, but I felt that we were still too much a central factor. I didn't know it was going to be the PLO come over the fence with the support of revolutionaries. It was going to be a small hit squad trying to assassinate us, or a massive intrusion. But I almost knew that would happen again. I did not share these totally gloomy views with everybody. And when I wrote to the secretary, I modulated my view to say that Americans would be in great danger or peril, I think is the exact words. I felt that if I said, and the American embassy is likely to invade again, I start to sound too frantic. So I left the country elated to be going and deeply gloomy about the future.
Well, was this the period when the embassy staff was coming back to a larger size?
Yes, in and out. A number of people who had been in the embassy before came back on some TDY. They came back to work for a few weeks, a few months, get their own effects, if you will, in order, and leave. I must say the State Department was extremely gracious and helpful and gave all of us options on what to do. And my option they gave to me when I was called by Henry Craig to ask me if I would be willing to take some leave in March and then go back and become chargé. But it was very clear that I didn't have to. And everybody else had an option to leave. In fact, I worked very hard in February with our staff to get people to hang on for another week or 10 days to get their affairs straightened out, extent they could, so that anybody who might come in the future wouldn't arrive and find a chaotic, find a particular job in chaotic condition. And I must say, the staff was extraordinary about that, because they asked, it was basically